Blog Talk Radio.
You know the day destroys the night, night divides the day. Try to run, try to hide, break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side. Break on through to the other side, yeah. We chased our pleasures here, dug our treasures there.
Welcome to Break On Through. Here, you can travel realms uncharted, blur lines, break the chains, open yourself to possibilities waiting to be discovered on the other side. I am Pam Ray. With me, as always, is my co-host, Intimidus Rex. Rex and I are poets on a website called All Poetry with a group of poets called Late Night Poets. You don't have to the group or the website to call in, to share, to listen, and enjoy, but it is highly recommended. Now, tonight is an after midnight show, which means we allow for a bit more adult content and language. If you find that this show is not your cup of tea, please check out our other shows. We have up to 1 to 2 shows per night on a variety of styles of topics and poetry, something to suit everybody's taste. Also, make sure when you get a chance to check out the poetry anthologies put out by Late Night Poets on Amazon, because when you purchase those, you not only get amazing poetry, you help support these radio shows. And hello, Rex. How's it going?
All right. What's going on?
Well, I don't usually drink coffee at 11 at night, but dang it, I just had to. I didn't think I'd make it through the show. Like, you know, I'd fall asleep and you'd have to just push my snoring carcass off to the side and finish the last hour and a half yourself. But, you know, but it's going good. I'm really looking forward to tonight's show. It's the part two of, we ran a big contest asking for surrealism and Dadaism inspired rites, which I am a big fan of. You know, I like that when you read a surrealistic poem and you have two or more poets commenting on it, you can get so many different viewpoints. And absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, in fact, I, and Dadaism, you know, I really like the whole idea that with Dadaism, that it's, as the one quote says, it is everything, it is nothing, you know, it is whatever you want it to be. It is the anti-art. In fact, there's this favorite quote of mine, and I'm going to see really quickly. Oh, here it is. This is my one of my favorite quotes about Dadaism is by Richard Holzenbeck, and it is, Dada is the sun, Dada is the egg, Dada is the police of the police. And I just really, really love that quote. Is that our hot tub that we're jumping into there, Rex, in Late Night Poets?
That's the only hot tub available, I guess.
Well, it looks big enough for me, you, and Jeremy to fit in.
One-person hot tub.
Well, you know, and if we can't all fit in, I'll sit on somebody's lap. I mean, I'm sure it can work. And speaking of Jeremy, hello, Jeremy. Welcome to the show. Glad you could join us.
The rails came off quick tonight, but someone says snoring carcass, and you know that I come running. How you guys doing?
Snoring carcass.
Too funny. So how are you doing?
I'm doing excellent. I look forward to another wonderful evening with the both of you guys. I always like hanging out with you two.
Ditto. And Rex is just so overwhelmed with emotion right now that he's silent.
Rex is still trying to figure out the math when you start talking about laughing.
Well, no, that carcass thing had me thinking because I just did something of turning carcasses into fresh sausages.
Oh, man. Speaking of changing carcasses, you have to, when you get a chance, Rex and Jeremy, check out the poem prompts I put up, not for this coming up after midnight show, but the one after. I think there's a couple that you'll really like. It's Kenneth Lester. Yeah, that's right. I chose. But anyways, I digress because that is neither here nor there. All right. So what do you say there, Sausage Man? You ready?
Yep.
All right. What do you got for us first?
Yeah, Disillusion by Tom Boston. Pricked by the bloom of winter flowers with thorns that soothe my skin, I watched the midday moonlit sky spread darkness from within. Bare and barren, broken trees shade night from reckless dreams. At dusk I wake from sleeplessness to silent, piercing screams. For miles I wander, standing still along this short-lived span. Each step I take just leads me back to where I walked began. Blind onlookers blind the route. With sightless eyes they stare. They jostle for position with the crowds that are not there. With lowered glass the portent toast to life's all I propose. Scent of decay is sweetened by the stench of summer rose. And poem. Thank you.
Wonderful read there, Rex. Yeah, this is just absolutely stunning. I like the dreamlike quality within it, and I'm looking forward to commenting more. But first, Jeremy, I'm going to want to get your thoughts.
Really enjoyed the undying contradiction that happens throughout the entire poem. And it goes with the there's the obvious picks of it, of contradiction. But I found it the nuance of it, too. I think he really kept to it, that dedication to that contradiction. And I kind of got lost in a couple of the lines because I really was was really taken aback by his sense of detail and the words that he used and how you're led one way and then you go the other way, and I say the contradiction, obviously. And it doesn't come across with that sarcastic feel that contradiction would have. There's a lot of playfulness in it, but it was spurring a lot of deeper thought. So there was like an ethereal feel to it, and it was kind of inviting you to get lost in the way that you play with the yin and yang of words, you play with the yin and yang of thoughts, the positive and negative of everything. So Disillusion is kind of an interesting title for this because it's more of Disillusion obviously has the negative connotations of being let down or you're not encouraged. And in the meat of this poem, I felt the exact opposite. I wasn't disillusioned by the contradiction. I was inspired by it. I was inspired by the fact that you can look at things from the other side of the coin, I guess. So I think Tom did a good job, and I feel it was 100% intentional, really stretching the imagination and definitely hitting a home run with the theme that we're going to be talking about tonight.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. And there really is a yin and yang feel to these lines, and a real sense of, you know, of feeling like the eyes wide open. It's always really wonderful when you can get lost in a particular line or two of a poem. So really well said there. And Rex, you read that beautifully. Your thoughts?
I could go with the thoughts with that opening stanza of the onset of age and the disillusion in the fact that, yeah, because he hits on the short-lived lifespan down in the second one, but kind of hits on that note of the stuff that they didn't get done or maybe that they wish they had. Barren, broken trees, shade night from reckless dreams. Kind of hits on that sort of taking the easy road instead of trying to actually branch out to something else. And the dusk I wake from sleepless, the silent piercing screams. The silent piercing screams could be his own. That sleeplessness hints on the thought of impending doom, the night closing in, death. Now that second one kind of hits on the fact that maybe he's walking within a land of ghosts. He's the in-between realm. And that thought in the last two lines, with lowered glass of port and toast to life's all, I propose. Scent of the case sweetened by the stench of summer rose. There's a note in when death does come, it is sweetened by the smell of that summer rose, having lived rather than just wished.
I really like that. I like that you brought up the fact that it kind of has that feeling of being amongst ghosts, of being in the in-between. And I really was intrigued with the line, with a lowered glass, a portent toast, to life's all I propose. The whole idea of making a toast with a lowered glass seems like such a contradiction that it really grabs the attention. And this is beautiful all the way through. Like I said, there's almost that dream-like quality that does fit really well as a surrealism rite. I really like also barren, broken trees, shade night from reckless dreams. At dusk I wake from sleeplessness to silent, piercing screams. Some wonderful darkness within those lines. And there's such an idea of like, of being, to me, of just being awoken to facing the reality of your fears. And so really just a strong write and very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
When Tears Cry, the short version by Roger Spatnarine. And this one's for you, Jeremy. I like the picture.
When Tears Cry, the short version by Roger Spatnarine. Saline sorrow wells optically, erupting in volcanic waves, spewing forth tides of emotions. Salty sands of insidious lava flows, flooding feelings with bittersweet burning wakes, clouding corneas soaked in grainy tidal crescent kisses. This pain's fluidity obscures one's hurtful views made worse by deafening silences of sound unseen. And that's what happens when tears cry. End poem.
Wonderful read there, Jeremy. And Rex, your thoughts on this poem?
Well, I like the thought of giving life to the thought of tears themselves, having their own vertical view, so to speak, saline sorrow, fluidity. They all work on the thought of motion itself, along with the lava, volcanic waves, clouding corneas. Got a nice touch of a little bit of alliteration rolling in here too. But it all hits on the notion of actually giving life to the tear without actually giving it the feelings that go along with it or the reasons behind the tears to begin with. Just the tear itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that you mentioned that, and that there isn't really a reason given for the tear, just that it exists. And I think that's so important and such a strong part of the poem, and I'm glad you brought it up, is because it leaves it open to the reader. The reader can put their own personal experience of what their most recent thing or most, you know, whatever tearful event they went through in their life that brought forth the tears, they can embed it into this right between the lines, and it becomes a more personal connection to them. So really great observation there, Rex. And Jeremy, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
Yeah, cool thoughts, guys, for sure. And I was thinking about that too, that there's really no explanation for what emotion is tagged with the tear. And I like the personification angle too that Rex brought to light. But it does come to sorrow in the third there. That's when it kind of associates some kind of emotion with it. I thought it was cooler earlier on, being that tears could mean several different kinds of emotions, but I think he kind of zeroes in on a little bit on the third and insinuates more that it's more of a sad, heartfelt emotion. I also like how this whole poem is framed by that last line in the fact that it's an explanation of what's going on. It's an explanation of something greater, I guess. It's trying to define something. The whole poem is framed much differently. If you take out that last line, the whole poem is left more nebulous in terms of what he's trying to attain and what he's trying to do with it. And it's less, it's not so well framed. It's not in a box. And I think by putting it in a box in that last line, kind of, it really changed it a lot for me. It's like saying, it's almost explaining an emotion that can't be explained. And then it's opening that fourth wall and saying, look, that's what we're doing. So it's like you're explaining it to a child or explaining to somebody that should know what tears are all about. And I kind of like that he framed it, again, using that word. I like the way that he pitched it with that last line. I don't know. It was a different curveball for me, and I like how it made the whole poem take on a different meaning.
It truly did. And you're right about that because it shows the importance of not only a strong ending, but, you know, choosing to, which lines to leave in and which to take out and how it's all a process that leans towards the final product. You know, my advice I like to give people on writing poetry is have a strong opening, a strong end, and put the shit somewhere in the middle so that by the time people get done reading the poem, they'll forget. This is why I don't teach poetry. But, no, I really like what you had to say about how that end line supports the rest of the poem and changes the tone of it. I really liked also the alliteration in this. It was a beautiful write all the way through. But I think particularly what stood out to me is the second stanza with the line, clouding cornea silk and grainy tidal crescent kisses. There's that whole idea to me of almost kind of finding a sort of comfort in the tears. So just a stunning write and very well done. And what do we got next?
With the Wind by Casey Day. That one's yours.
All right. With the Wind by Casey Day. We fly upon autumn breeze, leaves from very different trees, landing in one open steam, holding pieces of silent dreams. Locked inside winter's freeze, we steady our yearnings, please, returning to the earth by spring, hopeful new life we will bring. Soon sprout a tiny tree, upon its sprout tiny leaves, who one day fly upon a breeze, giving life to silent dreams. End poem. Oh, that was absolutely beautiful. And Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yes. And to steal what Rex said on the last poem, again, we have a personification here that really kind of took me away. I like the picture, and I like the idea of being part of it's not a dandelion. What are those things called? What am I looking at there? It's not a dandelion.
Oh,
that's a dandelion.
No.
That is.
Isn't it? Wow.
No, it's
sorry,
the one
guys,
they go
late at night. All right. No, but I mean, it's personifying a dandelion. And imagine being one of those seeds that gets to fly. I mean, I know as a kid, blowing those things and watching all the seeds fly was a fun pastime. But I like how, I mean, you said it right out of the gate, Pam. It's very beautiful. And imagining flying and being that and being part of that dream, I think this one kind of takes you away. I think Casey did a beautiful job of making something I would have never imagined from a viewpoint that I would never imagined and making it very enviable. I mean, maybe it kind of opens your eyes, right? It makes you open your eyes and want to walk around nature and say, you know, this is what poetry is all about, is being part of everything and looking at things from different angles. I think this one took my breath away a little bit. A very beautiful poem.
It is absolutely well said there. And you're right, it is a wonderful personification. So excellent comment. And Rex, your thoughts?
On a simple thought, it works well with the picture just on the premise itself because of the dandelion and how it is spread upon the wind. But with the closer look at the picture and how the root system is actually a person attached to that, to the dandelion on the wind, so to speak. It gives that thought to ideas spread upon the breeze, hopes spread upon the breeze, dreams, intellectual mediums spread forth to hit on new lands, new arenas, and bring life to those areas. So it walks better in that angle as opposed to just the simple thought of a dandelion sitting as it is just to spread its new age across the valley.
I like that. I like that, how you notice in the picture that there's kind of like it looks kind of like a person, the leaf does, like laying before the dandelion. Yeah, wonderful comment there. And I really liked this. It just had a beautiful, gentle quality to it. I like returning to earth by spring, hopeful new life we will bring. I like that idea of, you know, that sense of hope that goes out with each little seed that flutters off. I also like soon sprout a tiny tree upon its sprout tiny leaves. You know, I thought tiny tree was a really just a clever and thoughtful choice of wording because, to me, I feel like because of the personification of the dandelion seeds, that they see themselves as important. They don't see themselves as going to become weeds, as people often see them, but rather these little trees, that feel like there's this whole idea of finding you're following your dreams and finding your sense of purpose. So just a beautifully written and very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
E. God, A Guide to the Labyrinth by Mad Lad. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to read that piece. Insert foot fetish. Type. PRD. Post-marinating, penetrate the breathing and steam's vulva with your swollen right toe, while gently pressing the idle heel on the clitoris's pulse. Then, if wish be, you may massage your feet over the hairy carpet in the vicinity. This is this, and that is that. This is what, and what is that? Only a fool begins from the beginning. Any wise creep will tell you to thoroughly engage with the end and let the beginning write itself. So I tried to palm the Monday sun's sobriety and cusp it into a bulb for the butterflies. She sees, but in the unseeing she winks, but with her blind eye. Oh, the violence of light, I give you my word that if I ever recognize my voice, I'll call you by your true name, Daddy Darkness, ejaculatory accident. For now, let me take a butter knife and slice the thin bark of eucalyptus to fashion a bra for my eyes. There is too much space and too little presence, too many words, too little prominence. You trace a tiny cloud bubble oozing out of the afternoon moon's bloody nostrils, and abruptly attach it to the golden lace of a weasel's mustache. A nuclear explosion inside an apple seed is barely as imaginative as the sound of colors popping. Or is it, Miss, I know you did, Miss, I know you did stamps? The rise with an W and Ari. Will you believe what you want to believe except when you don't believe? And in your non-believing, more than a million Dalit teens braved their tongues into individual bottles, swarming with starved killer ants, only to find that even the sting of acid can't wash away this caste stain. We are soil made sacred for exclusive plunder. How cold must the fire turn for life to plagiarize its heat? I frame myself into a question and settle beside the Dorito dust on your cleavage. As you summon the delicacy required for cleaning a buoyant morning dew off the chainsaw's teeth with your tongue, you and I, following parallel lines, secretly strive to meet at infinity. Yesternight in my dreams, I saw my Lund buddy splitting amoeba-like into two and overheard his newborn halves plotting suicide at birth. But now, all I remember is that one particular dream character who was editing his identity without my awareness into my dreamscape. It was he who told me not to let poetry corrupt this dream-long experience of death. Can you ever die in your dream character's head? I apparently can. End poem.
Amazing, right? Well, that is amazing, right? But just a great read there, Rex. I tell you, now, you know, I always enjoy and appreciate Mad Lad's poetry. He has this way of really grabbing your attention, and his mixing up of almost, to me, what oftentimes seems like a form of self-loathing mixed with sexuality. Hits hard. And I think another thing I really like about his poetry is the fact that the way he, like, this is a beautiful vignette, but it's not a traditional vignette in that the way he separates it with, like, little things to say, like, insert foot fetish and so rise with a W and Ari not. You know, there's this kind of way of separating each part to let you know what part of the journey you're in, an unnecessary antidote to help you forget. You know, what I really like is that this takes us on a journey. And you trace a tiny cloud bubble oozing out of this afternoon moon's bloody nostril and abruptly attach it to the golden lace of a weasel's mustache, a nuclear explosion inside an apple seed barely as imaginative as the sound of colors popping. Those are just very striking lines. I also really liked Of the Violence of Light, I give you my word that if I ever recognize my voice, I'll call you by your true name. And the reason I like that is because it's almost like the whole idea of, you know, trying to reassure someone but you can't because you can't even reassure yourself. I also like the idea of cutting the eucalyptus for a bra for the eyes. And that, you know, for some reason that makes me think of the whole idea of because, you know, bras are used for lifting, you know, like the idea of lifting the eyes up, like seeing beyond the ground or seeing beyond oneself. I think when it comes to offering up a Dadaism or Surrealism tone within a rite, Mad Lad does a wonderful job. A buoyant morning dew off the chainsaw's teeth with your tongue. That stanza there, I mean, the whole stanza, I didn't even read the whole thing, but that whole stanza just really speaks on the, to me it's the idea of speaking at the wrong time, saying the wrong thing, and the poison, the hurt that can easily come from a misused tongue. So it's just a really strong write and very well done. And Jeremy, your thoughts?
I don't know about you guys, but a lot of times I lay in bed at night, exhausted from the day, and to be able to get to sleep, I start writing in my own head, right? I start coming up with poems, I come up with prompts, I come up with ideas and start putting ideas and words together and let the creative process flow until I fall asleep. Oftentimes I think, you know, these are really intimate thoughts, really, really great stuff. I should just write it down. But then I just kind of sit back and say, you know what? I'm just going to enjoy the ride right now. And if I can remember, and if indeed in the future I can share that, then that's a bonus. But if I don't, I'm not going to burden myself with turning on the light and writing down poetry and ruining the experience of what's happening right now. A really cool thing that you said about Mad Lad's style, Pam, is that how he grabs you and how he mixes the sensuality with the Dadaism, the thing, everything we're talking about tonight. And that really hits home. From the very beginning, he says, insert foot fetish, and then talks about a very sexual, graphic sexual experience. And you got to think about how exposed that is, right? First of all, to write about sex and intimacy like the way he does, but then how hard it is to find a partner that's into the same kind of fetish that you would be into. I mean, that's another level of vulnerability and exposure. And so it's a real intimate thing that's shared. But then I think what he does is he doesn't let, I mean, he gets away from the sexual to a degree, the in-your-face sexual explanation of what's going on, but it's still a very intimate explanation of what goes on in the future. I think all of this is, it's a fun ride. It's very cool thoughts. I liked all the excerpts that Pam picked up, she enjoyed. There were a couple more that I liked. I like Cuspid into a Bulb for the Butterflies. Further down, doesn't really matter, but there were a number of these that really hit home that I enjoyed, and I enjoyed the words, and I enjoyed the intimacy of what he was saying. And the fact that it was kind of explained at the very end of can you ever die in your dream character's head, apparently I can, that was the share, right? He was unabashedly letting his creativity flow, and he was sharing it, which in this diatribe of what I'm trying to say, that's a very intimate experience that you're sharing with your reader. And so I like that, how that was kind of carried through the entire poem. Very cool experience.
Absolutely. And you're right. It is an intimate experience shared with readers. I don't actually usually lay in bed thinking about poetry. I'm very much I'm focused right on where I'm writing if I'm thinking about poetry. But I get what you're saying. And yeah, he really does grab your attention. And sometimes you just have to, like, enjoy the ride. And Rex, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
Well, because of the fetish, the foot fetish, this comes across as a pay-for-play. Because he hits on one thought in here that she sees, but in the unseeing she winks, but with her blind eye, the little knowing nod, yes, I'm available, so to speak. And that sort of, oh, the violence of light, I give you my word that if I ever recognize my voice, I'll call you by your true name, Daddy Darkness's ejaculatory accident. It's that kind of note to almost a baby in the womb at that point in time. And that the thought, the butter knife and slice the thin bark of eucalyptus to fashion a bar off my eyes, is a note to sleepy time in that moment. And too much space, too little presence, too many words, too little prominence. Again, that thought to pregnancy and womb. See what else we got here. The nuclear explosion inside Napoli's belly is matched as the sound of colors popping. That hits on the same note of sexuality that he's got up top with the rest. And the thought is that single line, or is it Miss I Know You Did Stamp? Kind of offers the notion of it being that pay for play. And what else we got here? Then he hits on the cast stain. Can't wash away the sting of acid and the cast stain. The cast stain being the cast system. How you're born into a realm where this is your lot. You don't get any higher. And everybody sits within that in various realms within that system, but they are delivered unto it and they die unto it. So that kind of hits on that note. Then he gets back on the sexual angle again. I frame myself in your question and settle beside the Dorito dust on your cleavage as you summon the delicacy required for cleaning a buoyant morning dew off the chainsaw's teeth with your tongue. Now, there's the clever metaphorical guys within that piece by itself. Nicely done. And then you and I, following parallel lines, secretly strive to meet at infinity. The notion of orgasmic thrill. And the bottom end of this had me thinking again of the sort of conjunction, sperm meeting egg, and then the split. And then the split again, and the split again. That's sort of the hitting on it, splitting amoeba-like into two, newborn halves, plotting suicide at birth. There is that thought there are twins in the moment, and maybe one twin outgrows the other, and the other one does not make it. So that sort of can you ever die in your dream catcher's head? I apparently can. Kind of hits on that notion at the bottom end of one twin not making it within the womb while the other one consumes everything in sight.
I like that. That is some really great observations there, Rex. I like how you noticed that not only the obvious sexuality within the rite, but the references to the act of creating another life. So just a really great comment there. All right, now it is Jeremy's turn to read, correct? Because I need a few minutes, so it's at least a couple minutes. So if after Jeremy reads, you could leave comments. I'd appreciate that, Rex. I'll be right back.
You better save some shots for us, sister. Anomalous by T. Michelle.
Yeah, you might not like that shot. Anomalous on the board by T. Michelle, and that one to you, Jenny.
Anomalous, T. Michelle. In mangled rain, unconscious, I divined the symmetry of an obscure union. Brimming with coriander, I calculated the distance to Canaan and gift it to you with treacherous end in view. On a foreign mission with an empty cartridge, I'm without a mediator and you without a savior. The first lesson is that no magic of essence is needled in less than a grotesque spice, not the tendering of the Sphinx constellation, nor the soft landing for geometry and the runcinet quarters of Pythagoras. Let your candlelit eyes cut that dead thin thread. Their decimal balls balancing the frozen orange field, we owe it too much to the bow to diffract perfection. This bleeding promise of knowledge and its inexcusably feeble and shadow slain as the collapsible points of a nonagon rocking to divisible zeros. And were rings of breathless rose running down the slippery descent of an autonomous sky. Some of it all is the keepsake of a riddle, sickle spells of detached satisfaction, gluttonously devoured by paupers and the Library of Kings. Freedom is a head breadth of reckless gods in Tartarus. And the gatekeep of science and art, arrowheads drowsily for the marrow, feeding the listless seedlings of our sober paradise. The second lesson is the more important of the two. There is no such thing as a rival. End poem.
Great read, Jeremy. Thank you very much. All right. Let's see. All right. Let me go. All right. Anomalous. It kind of hits on that notion right there. Brimming with coriander, I calculated the distance to Canaan and gifted to you with treacherous ends in view. Boy, does that paint a nice official picture from a couple of thousand years ago. On a foreign mission with an empty cartridge, I'm without a mediator, and you're without a savior. The first lesson is that no magic of essence is needled into less than grotesque spice. Not the tendering of the Pyxis constellation, nor the soft landing for geometry, and the run-snip forces of Pythagoras. There's a notion of, if you walk within the realms of believing in magic to the point where it runs your life, then you actually miss the point of that which is life to begin with. The sort of coriander is a nice spice, has its own nice, flavor and aroma, and offers up that second point in the first lesson, grotesque spice, something abhorrent. Let your candle, let your eyes cut that dead thin thread, the notice of death walking its realm. And she hit down near the bottom. The second lesson is the more important of the two. There is no such thing as a rival. And it's kind of an argument don't put too much into what you see as a belief system as opposed to that which can be conjured from your own mind that can argue against such things. Science and art, they offer up different perspectives. In order for science to be proved, it has to be given out to all manner of a number of different people to actually regurgitate the same process to make it a truthful fact. And even then, somewhere down the line, it might change again. Art is changed by the thoughts of those individuals that walk within its realms and reckless gods and Tartarus. I like that thought. Our sober paradise. Kind of hits on the notion of taking care of walking through it with clarity and discernment of mind, body, and thought instead of corruption. Now that I butchered that, how about you? Jeremy, you there?
I'm here, buddy. I'm just unmuting. I'm with you. No, I like this. I like how in the beginning it's kind of set you up and it says, look, I don't have all the answers, but I'm going to give you how I feel, how it's going to break down. And so there's the first rule, the first lesson, and it goes into this long astrological explanation that just kind of lets go of the reins and rides. I mean, it's quite a trippy little giddy-up that happens. It's very fun to read, and it's fun to try to dissect and get lost in the words of what she puts together there. I think it was a really cool feel, and I think that's a part of it. It's just, you know what? Sometimes things come at you, and it's eye-opening, and it's hard to grasp the greatness of what you're feeling. And I think that's the contradiction that you have at the very end. The second lesson, which is more important than the two, is there's no such thing as arrival. There's no way of the second lesson is that you're never going to understand everything that just happened to you. And I like that the second lesson is much more flat than the first, because it makes the first that much more grandiose, and it kind of lets you go down that path, go down that rabbit hole of unbridledness, for lack of a better term. And what's really cool, I thought, was the choice of all this wonderful language that's chosen throughout this incredible rite, is the very last word. There's no such thing as arrival. And the word arrival, I mean, there's a lot of synonyms that she could have used there, but arrival was a really good way of just saying there's no way of totally understanding it all in a very succinct manner. So I like that, how that close, again, was very punctual compared to what happens in that first lesson. Very cool write, T. Michelle. I really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Pam, you back yet?
I am, and I think you both made just absolutely wonderful comments, and I liked listening to you delve into that poem. I really like this as a thought on the journey for the search for knowledge. For some reason, I'm particularly fond of when poems use spices, and so Brimming with Coriander was absolutely one of my favorite parts. That there, I calculated the distance of Canaan and gifted to you with a treacherous end in view. I like that whole idea of, you know, like reaching out your hand and saying, you know, here, take my hand. We're going to take this walk together. We're going to seek knowledge together. And the reason, you know, to me, you know, the use of spices, it works wonderfully as metaphors, because, you know, there's not only the flavor of them, the idea that you use them for cooking, but oftentimes they have medicinal value. And so there's this kind of sense of healing. I really like the bleeding promise of knowledge is inexcusably feeble and shadow slain as the collapsible points of a knowledge and rocking undivisible zeros. She has this way, and she even says it in the one lines where she mentions the combination of art, and I'm missing it here, but in the gatekeep of science and art, arrowheads read drowsily stacked for the morrow. There's this whole idea to me that knowledge is found, you know, when you bring science and art together. And I have to agree about that end stanza. There are so many different, you know, like, ideas that she could have put in there, but to end it with that, there's no such thing as arrival. And to me, what that really speaks on is the idea that you may think you've reached at total enlightenment, but you're going to realize that you still have so much more to learn, that this is just a small section of the journey. Really just a stunning rite all the way through, and very well done. And
I really like that. Before we move on, I really like that comment, Pam. I didn't even thought about that, about the use of spices. Not only are a lot of spices fun to say in terms of the lyrical value, but yeah, you're stimulating another sense, and you're bringing in your reader on another level. And I've never really thought about that. I really like that comment.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, it is like I said, it really does bring in a different, like you said, different senses I brought in. All right. And what do we got next, Rex?
Maelstrom Forming by Mamyor. And that one's all yours.
All right. Maelstrom Forming by Mamyor. Maelstrom forming in the horizon. Coming, run, run, run through the door into bright sunshine, cherry blossoms fluttering. Bulls chasing you in downtown Tokyo. Turn sharp left, wade in a poppy field. Inhale, exhale, sleep, sleep, sleep. Eyes open. Sadako looks down from the ceiling. Limbs frozen. Pushes you, push, push, push. Over the balustrade. Hang on, hang on. Your neck in a noose, made of bleeding hearts. Wake, 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 are you? Poem. Wow, there's a real kind of energy to that rite. because with having no punctuation, it just felt like something that, like in one gasp, needs to be pushed out. Really quite intriguing and well done. But and Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I like the maelstrom forming, so the chaos, the impending doom forming. And to me, this is, I like how the respite from it was to go out into nature. I like how you're running out into the open, you're running out and getting away from all of it. So this was kind of a, for me, it was kind of a, how do I describe it? It was getting away from the claustrophobia of a city life and going out and being out in nature. And so it's, and that's what I really felt with all the repetition, is it seems like there was a lot of pressure from keeping up or being in the rat race of life. And it's kind of, for me, it was a call to just go out into the poppy field, inhale, exhale, just kind of feel the world that's less oppressive. And so that's the maelstrom that was beating down for me. I think, Mama, y'all used some really cool techniques in here that made it very oppressive, and you do feel that there's that impending pressure coming down. And so I like that.
Absolutely. And I like what you had to say about, you know, escaping the pressure and the city life to go find somewhere to relax. So well said there. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, I could walk it through as a sort of a dream. Run, run, run through the door, the bright sunshine, cherry blossoms fluttering, bulls chasing you. You get that little haphazard notion to things not occurring in a formulaic realm, but they unfold as your mind works through the day's daily angles, which stuck but never materialized in the moment. But the thought with Tokyo and Sadako had me thinking of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, because Sadako was a girl who survived the bombing during World War II, or the end of World War II, at the age of 2 years old. I'm wondering if it also speaks to Sadako, also hints on the sort of ghosts that wither around, and maybe this is supposed to be a bit of a haunting, and the thought you get to the back end, there is a place, I forget, they call it the Hanging Forest. It's a place where a lot of people go to commit suicide. Because you got hang on, your neck in a noose made of bleeding hearts. Wake, are you? So I'm kind of torn between a number of things, although when it comes down to that back end, it might very well be of what the maelstrom formed into. And everything that led up to the back end of this, it might be that the suicide forest itself.
I like that. You always have a little extra information, like about that place that you just mentioned, that, you know, it's famous for people going to hang themselves. And there is kind of a very dreamlike quality to the idea of the lines of where it says, through the door into bright sunshine, cherry blossoms fluttering, bulls chasing you in downtown Tokyo, turn sharp left, wade in a poppy field. You know, there's that idea, you know, how oftentimes in dreams there will be just these sudden changes that don't even make sense. But what I really enjoyed this write and appreciated it for its the way she used the style that kind of just flowed down in a narrow line, very short lines, no punctuation, just almost a rushed feel to it. The idea of and I like that she ended it a question, you know, like wake, are you? The idea that it gives us the opportunity to think: was this a dream? Was it a reality? You know, what realm have we crossed into? So, really, is a beautiful and thoughtful write and very well done. All right, Rex, what do you got for us next?
The Penultimate Hotel by Stuart Stafford. Enter sluggishly into the lobby. A banquet is in progress in the restaurant. They're regurgitating reality from within and then eating their young. An apocalyptic porter has radioactive cubes in the lift. Housekeeping will have 10,000 years of life, but the sheets in the rooms will all turn to cream cheese. The cooks in the kitchen are breaking bones and rules, creating a cake that stretches to infinity. Babble, babble, with protesting eggs, all baked in a hellfire oven. The concierge gives out tips and tells guests they are awful and to leave, while simultaneously tattooing diabolical potion recipes of willing bellhop eyelids. And poems.
Now, this is a really interesting write, and that was a great read there, Rex. Oh, my goodness. I got to say, this is I feel like this delves really well into the dark side of Dadaism and Surrealism. Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yeah, it does hit the dark side, but it's titled The Penultimate Hotel, so it's the best possible hotel that could possibly exist. And you walk through the doors slowly, and there's a banquet going on, and then all of a sudden you get into it. So I felt like I was kind of suckered into this poem. I mean, I came in not ready, and then all before I knew it, the wheels fell off and things went all to shit. And I kind of enjoyed it. I kind of enjoyed the craziness of what I had tripped into once I came into this penultimate hotel. I love that the sheets turn to cream cheese. I love the babble babble with protesting eggs. I mean, this whole thing was just it was hellish for sure, but it was, I mean, I guess I'm smiling through the hell with fanged teeth. I don't know how else to put it. It was a very fun ride. Very cool poem, Stuart.
Oh, absolutely. And you're right. There is a dark humor to it. And it is one of those that, like you said, once the shit show starts, you know, you just can't help but smile, you know, at all the body parts and bones and blood being flung around in complete chaos. So excellent comment there. And Rex, your thoughts?
You got to look at this from a different point of view. Instead of the guest, you got to look at it from the employee's point. It's dark, yes, and it's got a touch of dark humor to it, but that's for a reason, because if you take it too seriously as being part of the staff itself, then you end up being actually the little end of this, the sort of the apocalyptic quarter. Cooks breaking bones and rules, the concierge giving out rotten tips and telling the guests how awful they are and to leave. The idea is that not taking the job so seriously that you actually become the job. There's supposed to be a bit of fun in it. That's where the last line kind of hits on that notion. Tattooing diabolical potion recipes inside a willing bellhop's eyelids. It's a notation that, hey, like everything in life, don't take it so seriously that you become it instead of that which it's supposed to represent.
I like that. I like that. Yeah, the whole, and then having worked for some time in the past as a someone who cleaned at a hotel, it definitely can get pretty crazy. Not quite this crazy, but yeah. Especially when they show up for the Spooner Rodeo, or, you know, you get the college kids on vacation. But, yeah, I really liked how this does use the dark humor. You know, this is a really clever write, and I was particularly drawn to and fond of the second stanza, but the sheets in the room will all turn to cream cheese. The cooks in the kitchen are breaking bones and rules, creating a cake that stretches to infinity. You know, just the whole idea of creating the kind of imagery that baffles the mind, you know, and I don't know, it's just a really clever write all the way through and very well done. And
where are you going? Before we move on, so Rex, you're saying, I really like that. So you're saying, look at it from the perspective of the staff. And are you saying,
yes,
don't take your job too seriously? Or are you saying don't let your job get you down? Or kind of repeat what you're saying to me in there again.
Both things. Because if you take it too seriously, then it takes the fun out of the job to begin with. And if you don't enjoy your job, then you end up being that that concierge that tells you how bad you are to get out. There's that idea you've still got to have a bit of fun at work, because once you get to that level, then you become the apocalyptic porter who's willing to offer up atomic ice cubes or the girl who does your room and leaves the sheets from the last 10 guests complete with their spoils all over it, that cream cheese.
Uh-huh. Hey.
That's too much of a knowing voice. You know that situation too well. Cool.
Yeah.
Thoughts, guys. Very cool thought. Very cool thought.
I have to agree, yeah, Rex. Now, Rex, speaking of having fun at work, didn't you at one point jump out of a cake at your job? I remember you telling that story.
Yeah, I did that once many, 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 many years ago.
I like to envision the idea of you jumping out of a cake.
I didn't. The damn ballroom was fucking cold.
Too cool. Too cool. All right. What do you got for us next, Rex?
A Lady with Artificial Gills by Beatnik. I think you're going to enjoy this one, Jeremy.
The Lady with Artificial Gills by Beatnik. The lady with artificial gills rides a giant sea monkey for thrills. She can breathe the fresh air, too, in a fantasy world of sky and deep blue. Amid airships of fantastic invention, this lady defies all convention, her world too dreamlike to mention. Oriental junks and islands lush with green, she bears witness to magical scene dressed in all her finery. A pistol on her belt, how does she keep her powder dry? With a candle lantern that seems out of place, she keeps herself safe at night. So she goes living the life of upper society with her sea monkey in a top hat. They're a sight to see in an otherworldly world in the sea. End poem.
Wonderful read there, Jeremy. Man, I have to say, this is like nonsense poetry at its best to me. You know, like the whole like just fantasy realm of almost like ridiculousness, even though it tells a cohesive story, but it's a cohesive story, you know, that just really, you know, has such elements of, like I'm having trouble forming the thought, but you know, like the whole idea of a lady with artificial gills riding a giant sea monkey for thrills is just so far out there, that you know it does go into that realm of kind of that Lewis Carroll type nonsense poetry that really to me is just wonderfully captivating. I really like this all the way through, but especially Oriental Junks and Islands Lush with Green, she bears witness to a magical scene dressed in all of her finery. You know, to me, I honestly, there's this idea. You remember there was that movie, I think it was, and it's a pretty old one, but it had like this guy who talked to a giant rabbit, like he hallucinated the giant rabbit.
Oh God, what was the name of it? Harvey.
Yes, yes. It reminds me of Harvey the Giant Rabbit. It has that feel to it. I think this is just really creative and very well done. And Rex, your thoughts?
Steampunk. Artificial Gill, Sea Monkey, Amid Airships, Fantastic Invention, Lady Defies All Convention, Her World, Too Dreamlike Dimension, Oriental Junk, Pistol on a Belt. Kind of does scream the thought of steampunk, and she being the upper crust lady with the sea monkey in a top hat. There's almost a comical fantasy angle at the back end of that.
I like that, yeah. Yeah, it does have that feel to it, that steampunk feel. So very cool, very cool. And Jeremy, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
I really like the Lewis Carroll comment, but I think there's a way that you can do this, that you can go off the rails and write crazy poetry and totally lose your audience. And I think there's a way, and what Beatnik did here is I stayed engaged with it. I wanted to keep I wasn't lost by it. I was smiling and I was enjoying it. So when you get into fantasy and you get into craziness and you get into these really, really complex imaginary conglomerates of ideas, you can, again, you have to somehow keep your reader interested. And I was very much interested in this. I wanted to be part of this magical scene. What I liked is how we switched from the format and the fact that we were rhyming and doing couplets and triplets until we got to dressed in all her finery. And then all of a sudden there was a snap two in the poem. And that next stanza is really kind of interesting, where it says a pistol on her belt, she keeps herself safe at night. It was like it was a break from the ride for a minute when you dressed in all her finery and then went to that next stanza, and then you go back again to the rhyming and you go back to the musical carnival ride. So to me, I really like the intelligence of that, because it was like a snap out of the phantasmical craziness that we're experiencing, the tornado, the whirlwind of creativity. And it's like, you know what? We don't get lost on this acid trip too much, because we still have that gun on our hip that can keep us grounded. I don't know. I think that this was a very clever written, cleverly composed poem. And again, I like the way that it was not just a bunch of nonsense. There was actually a lot of thought to how this all came together.
Absolutely. I have to agree. Well said there. And what do we got next, Rex?
We Were Told Fairy Tales by Kiko, and that one's yours.
All right. Once upon a time, their youthful whispers lost to dreamy winds lay bare to aged ears, silent until it deafened, deafening ever after. We were told fairy tales amidst space between stars, how they twinkled to languid eyes, radiant until it faded, fading ever after. We were told fairy tales around candlelight, mystifying moths to their flame, warmth until it burned, burning ever after. End poem. Well, that was absolutely beautiful. And Rex, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
All right. Sold the cell, the hard cell of hope, without actually growing up past those once upon a time fairy tales. So where the fairy tale lingers long into long past teenage into 20s life, and the disillusionment that comes with it, because you're looking for those societal bits where, oh, my fairy tale is going to come true. But reality is, fairy tales are just children's stories, meant to be children's stories, not to be followed through in adult years, because they are just that, fairy tale.
I like that. I like how you touched on the idea that, you know, we need to grow out of those fairy tales, and how oftentimes it's even, you know, like the little things, like, you know, the expectations of what adulthood will be like that become a part of the fairy tale. You know, so really just a thoughtful comment there, Rex. And Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yeah, very cool comment. I looked at it from more of a literal standpoint, and it was really sad because, yeah, I have little ones running around, and I'm starting to read them books. And you remember when you first started hearing some of these fairy tales, how fun it was to get lost in the stories. And this kind of made me sad for growing older and not being able to lose myself in the imagination that is presented once you hear a fairy tale for the first, second, third time, and you're able to kind of imagine that maybe life can be that way. I don't know. The way that fairy tales kind of frame things. And so from a literal sense, yeah, it's kind of sad that you kind of grow out of that belief in Santa Claus kind of thing, you know? Cool poem.
Yeah, it truly is. There is that sense of sadness that comes with, you know, the idea that when you realize that you're never going to go back to those fairy tales, to that belief, you know, in Santa or any mythological figure. I really liked this brevity all the way through, but mystifying moss to their flame, warmth until it burned, burning ever after. You know, I really liked how that conveyed kind of the thought that even though you don't believe in the fairy tales anymore, they're always a cherished memory. I also felt like there's kind of this underlying thought of the idea of how we don't always prepare children well for adulthood within the fairy tales that we tell them. So just a really great write and very well done. And Rex, what do you got for us next?
Battle in the Inn by Greg Gall. In I'd slide, then slid into the id, inside the thorny thicket, 10 foot high, buried behind my mind, where it has hid, arising around me, no way to get by. In the throes of the hedgerow the ego goes, a word warrior of literate gore, sits there a moaning monster as it grows, each foe that's fought, it brings on one more. A volley of verses is too insane, how self survives and thrives as ego contrives. Why is there no reason one can explain? They take on all comers, ending their cries. That battle that we wage and want to win, if you do, you slayed you within. End poem.
Wonderful read there, Rex. I got to say, I really enjoyed the inner and end rhyme within this rite, and I thought that was a very clever title. And Jeremy, I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, totally true, Pam. I mean, the poetic devices are thick throughout this one, and it was a great read, Rex. This is a wonderfully sounding, rhyming, alliterative poem. It being inner self, wrestling with your inner self, wrestling with your inner beliefs, and this one kind of twists and turns all over itself, and I enjoyed the wrestle. I enjoyed, it's something that's very... very believable by any reader. Everybody can realize that they have their own demons. And I like the way that this wrestles with itself, but it does so in a fun manner, just in the style that it was conveyed. Very great write, Greg. I enjoyed it very much.
Absolutely. And, yeah, wonderful use of quiet devices. And I like how you mentioned that this is relatable to pretty much anyone because we all have our inner demons that we struggle with. So well said there. And Rex, your thoughts?
Well, he did it as a sonnet, which was a nice touch, something a little different. But it does a battle on that sort of the argument with oneself, the ego. How far do you let it render itself? How far do you let it out? How far do you go before you actually make this mistake of tripping over yourself and then falling into that that well-worn cavity of yeah, I told you so, but you wouldn't listen. The little argument within the head, which comes in those last two lines, that battle that we wage and want to win, if you do, you've slayed you within. So there's that nice note of finding a little bit of common ground, so the ego doesn't totally outweigh the conscious mind, which offers up a bit more of a mellow you, as opposed to the ego-driven bore, which would come out and tear people and yourself to shreds.
Oh, I like that. I like how you mentioned the idea of crossing the line and tearing yourself and people into shreds. But what I was really glad you brought up, Rex, was that there is in a sonnet form. And that is really cool because, you know, the content of the poem itself does fit really well with a surrealism style because of the fact that, you know, the id is not something physical. It's something psychological, emotional. It's something, you know, there's no exact body part called the id. It is a certain part of your conscience or your spirit. And so I thought combining that thought with a form that has very specific rules was a bold call for the right, and I'm glad you did bring up the sonnet form. You know, wonderful, some wonderful alliteration here, great rhyme. I really like a word warrior of literate gore sits there among monsters that grows each foe that's fought it brings on one more. You know, and to me there's this kind of idea of never being able to let those battles go. Just a great write all the way through and very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
For My Lover by Curtis X. Meyer. And Jeremy, you're up.
All right, Curtis, this is an old post, so it better be a good one, buddy. For My Lover, Curtis X. Meyer. Our first kiss was the sound of a wind chime in a hurricane, a desperate attempt to find melody in the midst of turbulent chaos. I have a problem staying awake when my lover opens up discussions of significance at 3 a.m. I don't always sleep right. There are two types of people who think fast, those who solve equations in their head and those who panic. I have never been that good with math. Ever since I was a kid, I've been able to close my eyes too easily. Rocket my consciousness past the barriers of perception so fast. You can actually hear the sounds of my dreams catching up to me, and I promise you, you're in every one. I don't know what it's like to work extra shifts and still not have enough money to pay rent, but I do know what it's like to be told to follow your ambition by the same person who tells you to get a job. I know two Diet Cokes and a cup of coffee don't count as breakfast the same way six Red Bulls and two smoke breaks won't ever count as a square meal. I've seen you bite bullets and spit out cannonballs. At night we speak our own language composed of broken English and pillow talk, half dreams and text scribbled with feathers left over by angels with wings made of razor blades. Confucius said, if you get a job you love, you'll never have to work a day in your life. We prefer to take the night shift, swapping each other's shivers as currency. I don't give you my heart, I offer you my rib cage so that you may make butterfly nets big enough to capture midnights. Had I the power, I'd make you dream catchers out of lightning so that the nightmares fly out of your skull. They don't just hang. They explode like insects and bug zappers. You and I have been ones to dread the dark. So here's hoping your hopes get a head start as your worst fears spread sparks. Because I've watched your bed arc under the weight as your weight like bait for unfed sharks. Still, you never surrender your tender heart. We've both been stark pretenders, contenders, defenders, avengers of a dead art. And I remember the days wondering why you didn't take off your suspenders until I realized they were tread marks. Truth is not stranger than fiction. It is just in this world devoid of storybook endings, those who live happily ever after are in a serious denial. We both know that easy and convenience are not the same thing. We both know that the best stories have been already told, Boy meets girl, boy leaves girl, boy revives, receives comfort from new girl, boy and new girl fall in love, boy and new girl struggle. We both know what it's like to be pinned down by our own DNA strands, to fear the day when we both become our, because some people hold on to grudges tighter than their own children. The distance doesn't care. You just lay there, patient as an iceberg, staring intently and expressionless. I can particularly hear you blink, enveloped by the cold blue ocean of your mattress, trying to find air between the waves of your sheets. You cry like no one I've ever seen, with tears more syrup than liquid, thick enough to cement together bricks to rebuild broken homes. So in the silence to become overwhelming, I have curled up beside you. It's because you're the only one I feel comfortable around. Sometimes my thoughts travel faster than the speed of sound. Sometimes my blood travels faster than the speed of thought. When you find me mumbling incoherently, I'm not talking in my sleep. It's just the sound of my dreams catching up to me. End poem.
Excellent read there, Jeremy. Okay, Rex, go ahead. Dive on underneath that iceberg and give us your thoughts, please.
Let's go with the back end of birch bark caning, 20 years late, broken and heavy, with weighted luggage upon both their backs. Yes. There's that one little thought that hits in here that really kind of sits on nicely because of the used it twice. Ever since I was a kid, I've been able to close my eyes too easily, rock up my consciousness past the barriers of perception so fast, you can actually hear the sounds of my dreams catching up to me. And I promise you, you're in every one. And he hits that again at the back end of this. It's just the sound of my dreams catching up to me. I'm not talking incoherently. There's a notation of, he hits on DNA strands, and he hits on thoughts of love and loss and pain. Here you got this, and I remember days wondering why you didn't take off your suspenders. Until I realized they were treadmarks. Okay. Then the thought to never restraining your tender heart. Wait like bait for unfed sharks. There's a notation of always hitting on the back end of life, so to speak. That's why the kind of hit on that note of birch rod caning, something that's lingered in the subconscious, been mutilated on the mind, and is carried across decades until they finally meet each other. And there's a convergence of two opposites, Diet Cokes and a cup of coffee versus six Red Bulls, two smoke breaks. But then again, at night we speak our own language, broken English and pillow talk. Angel with wings made of razor blades. There's such a clever thought of wanting the normalcy of that which is, but finding the ease within each other in that moment. And there was really nice touch in here, was that had I the power, I'd make you dream catchers out of lightning, so that when nightmares fly out of your skull, they don't just hang, they explode like insects and bug zappers. So there's a common core at the beat of each two.
Was that the end of your comment, Rex, or did you just cough in the middle of it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I have to say, that was a really great comment there. I really like that part of your personality is you take time to think before you start to speak. So there is occasionally that few seconds where I think, did he drop? I really like how you brought up that bug zapper part, and how that whole idea to me, when you were talking about that part, it really gave me that idea of wanting to destroy what has hurt another person. And I know you didn't use the word balance exactly, but, you know, I like that you touch on the whole idea of them kind of finding that balance, that calm, that within each other. So really great observations there, Rex. And Jeremy, you read that wonderfully, and hopefully you got yourself a drink of water.
Yeah, that was a hell of a long piece.
Wasn't it?
Funny how they always land on me, you guys. Funny how I always get the long ones.
We discussed what rice you're going to get before the show.
No, I enjoyed it. I think this is cool, Curtis. I think sometimes you can get lost in these longer story poems, but to me this was kind of Bukowski-esque. It was the grit and the storied poem of a couple going through it. I mean, the title is For His Lover. And I think there's enough of it that enough meat to the story. I mean, everything that I like about Bukowski is just that it feels just so real, right? And it just feels like you know the guy that's writing this poem because you've seen him at the track. And I think to this, there's a little bit of that. I think it's a storied poem, and there's been relationships in your youth when you're young and you're going through it and you're trying to make your way. And that had that kind of flavor to me. I think that what Curtis did is he added a little bit of existentialism to it and made it a little bit more abstract in areas, but just touches to say, you know what, this is a private relationship and I'm not going to let you guys know everything that I'm talking about because this is for my lover. And she knows what we went through. She was laying there with me and she's been through it too. So I think it was kind of an intimate poem that was shared in a really cool way.
Absolutely. I like that you mentioned the intimacy of the poem and the idea that how sometimes it goes into the abstract because, as you said, you know, we don't need to know everything. And I do like how there's almost, I like how the ending, the last stanza, kind of connects with how long the style of the poem with the sometimes my thoughts travel faster than the speed of sound. There's that whole idea of sometimes when you're writing almost, and not that this is a complete flow of consciousness, because obviously, as you said, Jeremy, it's a story style, right? But there is a kind of a flow to it that you just feel like those, those thoughts that you don't hold back. I really like that there's offerings up of the idea that the kind of poetry, the kind of thoughts that you have, after midnight or at 3 a.m. I was also really like you didn't take off your – and I remember Dave's wondering why you didn't take off your suspenders until I realized they were tread marks. And that whole idea of realizing that somebody bears the scars of their past experiences – I thought was really powerful lines and just a strong write all the way through and very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
The Evil Eye by Cool Mail. That one's yours.
Ah, right. I was giving Evil Eyes earlier in LNP today. So that's perfect. All right. The Evil Eye by Cool Mail. And it goes like this. I traveled to the evil eye and asked it nicely, lift the curse, but things have simply gotten worse. This I can no longer deny. This morning when I dropped my toast, it landed on the butter side. I could have stripped it off its hide, this evil eye, and made a roast. And yesterday I hit my knee when getting up from my own desk. I wished for fates grim and grotesque. On this damned eye for all to see. My market moves, kept falling still, the thing goes up and I go down. I've noticed I met with a frown, the evil eye must have a shill. Persistent is this evil eye, this I can no longer deny, this incantation written verse. Perhaps it'll rid me of my curse. End poem. And Jeremy, your thoughts.
Yeah, this has a much more lighthearted feel to The Dark Cloud. I like that the evil eye, I traveled to the evil eye. It's a destination. But then it's something that stuck with her throughout. Even though it's an aw shucks and it's a damn it, and like I said, it's a dark cloud, it has, I don't know if it's the rhyme factor, I don't know if it's the format, I don't know if it's just, it has a very lightheartedness feel to it. It's not downtrodden. It's not sucking you in. It's saying, you know what? Sometimes you get the raw end of the deal, and perhaps you'll be able to get rid of it. So, I don't know. The way it was pitched, it was enjoyable, and it made me smile much more than dragging me down to the evil eyes, impending doom. Cool poem.
Absolutely. And you're right. There's something in the format and the presentation and the rhyme that kind of softens it. So you know that it's a dark right, and yet you can't help but smile at some of the lines. I mean, well, especially that second stanza. I mean, come on, who can't relate to the idea of always dropping their toast butter side down, you know? So I thought that was very cool. And Rex, your thoughts?
It's the persistence of memory. Those little things that keep occurring, reoccurring, and imagine to reoccur once more, that gives the impression of being cursed or having the evil eye dropped upon you. So the idea is to wish upon a star, so to speak, by wishing upon the evil eye to remove that. But the actuality is it's part of the persistence of memory in the chain of things and your perception of those things as they walk through your day.
I like that. The persistence of things as they walk through your day. Very cool there. And you know, this actually, it makes me think of the book by Stephen King, Sinner, where the guy gets cursed by a gypsy. But I thought it had great rhyme and flow, wonderful creative storytelling, and, you know, just a really great write. So very well done. And what do you got for us next, Rex?
I have, let's see, I've got Into Arcadia by Jay Newall, and that one's mine. Now I got a feeling it's going to be a decently long one. Yeah, I took a peek. Definitely a long one. Into Arcadia by Jay Newall. Arcadia, 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 Arcadia. One word to remember. Our past lives, the ones we had before waking. The five of us can't recall how we found ourselves stuck in our own clearings. But through the thicket of jagged reeds, stretching miles, we found each other. Arcadia, Arcadia, it feels more familiar, walking the path we're on, crunching of the ground, caked in frost, despite the warmth I feel. You looked to me then as we walked, the haunting bleak gray beginning to surround us, gray sun, gray trees, graying air. We walked through a point, a sharpened pinhole, where the grays of the sky and soil combined to one spot, one door. And then we were somewhere alive. Arcadia, Arcadia, that was a place, Arcadia. We drew closer and closer, the world exploding into colors beyond our comprehension, the reds and purples giving the pinks and oranges, the periwinkles, violets and greens, the most vibrant green. Colors so bright they hum, glowing with their gentle songs. Towering gelatinous columns with palms of gold dancing quietly in a breeze too subtle to notice. Flowers of all forms, ferns that grew to grassy hills and the most ethereal blue horizon. We were so astonished, so amazed by this place that we were drawn in by it. Whatever we started to recall vanished in the next breath. The air was lighter, the steps easier. We found ourselves adrift. Why move on? Why tire ourselves when here is so magical? It was then when you noticed the lightning forming, long bolts of energy throwing themselves at the ground, barreling towards us. And he looked at me as we ran. The others took their tracks, to fall into a ravine or be trapped in a clearing, nowhere to hide. One by one, they slipped from view until it was just us running, running, the gray rushing back at us. Arcadia, Arcadia, that's where we are, the place we all long waited to see, the memory of crashing, re-entering the atmosphere in a teardrop of flame, returned as the gray enveloped the last of the oasis around us. He looked to me and said, jump, though I can't recall you saying it. We jumped into that crystal blue pool, the iris of the planet, water so clear you could see a pulse beating, beating into little ripples all over. We hid there as the sky darkened, the gray inking the ether. I closed my eyes, and you did too. And we were both somewhere else, a desert, dry and barren, the sand blowing in the morning haze, a figure in a white dress flowing, staring grimly at us both. Sand beyond our reach, just beyond. She clutches her chest, her gut, her dress blotched by dust kicked into the air, moaning, why do you hurt me? Why do you hurt me? We look to each other, hands held together tightly, and wake on the pool shore. She is gone. So is everything. The water dried up, the plants dead, the wind blowing restlessly across the whole of the planet. Arcadia, Arcadia, I am so very sorry. Eden, Arcadia, we know not what we've ruined. And drink, and boom.
Wonderful read there, Rex. I see that our plan to have only you and Jeremy read the long rights is working out perfectly. Jeremy, your thoughts on this poem?
Yeah, I read it as a, I see the classification at the bottom as sci-fi, nature, and dream, but I read it as more of a commentary on class. I saw it as a group of five young kids getting exposed to something that was unattainable or something that they were, that was not in their current class structure or what they've been raised in, and them getting a taste of something better. I like how that was constant. The way of describing the distance, the difference between what they were used to, what they came from, as being gray, and everything was gray. You kept using the word gray. And then when you're talking to Arcadia, you use these beautiful colors. Even the repetition, the one line that I really liked was periwinkles, violets, and greens, and then it's the most vibrant greens with an exclamation point. I think that was a really cool use of repetition and that punctuation on how color was used to describe how much more desirable this Arcadia was. Could be missing the mark. This is some kind of class, some kind of metaphor for class structure, but that's how I viewed it. I imagine just this ragtag group of kids experiencing something that they couldn't have in their life. So, cool poem.
Yeah, I like that thought, the whole idea of, I like that you saw that and pulled that out of the poem, and the idea of this kind of idea of discovery beyond one's class structure. It does get almost kind of a coming of age type feel to it. I really too was drawn to the repetitiveness of Arcadia, and that, I think what really helped with that too is though is that when Rex added a certain inflection to doing the repetitiveness of that word, it had an almost incantation type feel to it. But great comment there, Jeremy. And Rex, you read that wonderfully. Your thoughts?
Well, Arcadia has always reflected one simple thing, rustic simplicity, unbroken beauty, unspoiled, not denatured, with its only simplistic beings that were already there, undespoiled. That's the nature behind Arcadia as it sits. We even called at one point, Canada was referred to as Arcadia by the Europeans before it was started getting populated because of its rustic beauty and charm. And the same thing with the upper peninsula of the New England Valley down to the Great Lakes because of all that beauty. And that's what this is, and it's the spoilage therein of reading it meeting it, and not taking care of it in between, but just letting it go to waste. And that's where the back end of this is on, sort of, we know not what we've ruined. Arcadia is supposed to be the ultimate representation of Earth, because it hits on that note of the little blue pool dove into. And, yeah, there it is. We jumped in that crystal blue pool, the iris of the planet, water so clear, you could see a pulse beating into little ripples all over.
Absolutely. Yeah, I like how you bring up the idea that, yeah, Arcadia does represent that perfection in nature, and the idea that along the way we've destroyed it. I also read Arcadia was in Greek mythology, was the home of Pan, which, you know, makes sense. I just thought this was a really strong rite. Flowers of all forms, ferns that grew to grassy hills, and the most ethereal blue horizon. We are so astonished, so amazed by this place. I like how within those lines there's that childlike wonder. And then as you go down, it starts getting more and more dark as they realize, the horror, the death, the destruction. You know, she clutches her chest, her gut, her dress blotched by dust, kicked into the air, moaning, "Why do you hurt me? Why do you hurt me?" It feels like, you know, that like a kind of a personification of the planet crying out for mercy. It's just a powerful rite all the way through and very well done. And, all right, what do we got next?
We have got Toucan by Leon Falkenhorst. Jeremy, you're up. It's a lot shorter than the last one.
Toucan by Leon Falkenhorst. Behind and under my leather steering wheel, my hand adjusted a defroster knob like the radio, while out the windshield in midnight rain, on freeway guardrails, at the interchange, curved a half a dozen overturned canoes curled as the talons of 37-foot-tall toucan perched over my nervous Honda passed through the under beside. Another me pinched my ear from the passenger seat and twisted it like a beer cap that needed an opener. Ow! What? I approached the curb in the Honda again from where the defroster knob was fiddled with 1 minute ago, and again, the toucan leaned over. My passenger copy of myself was shocked like Schrodinger's cat exploding into shotgun shells. It snowed feathers. The Honda was crammed with 7 copies of myself scrambled like spaghetti code. Hands and pants, feet kicked, and bit necks with mouths coming out of arms. Windshield, toucan again. The moon, now a huge toucan eye. The sky was another toucan, and the Honda flew off the air into the night with my 17 shelves and a centrifuge can molecularly mixing as outer space liquid, shaking as eggs that hatch toucan chicks in a spring day jungle. In Brazil, we, as in I, were reborn on Earth after the unraveling of my known universe. End poem.
Great read there, Jeremy. I have to say, I really liked this write. I just thought it had wonderful imagery, and I really enjoyed the trip that you took us on. And Rex, your thoughts?
I like the absurd notion of his unraveling. There is a nice twisted touch of humor to sit there and explain yourself in such a fashion as to how you died, and having that sort of Schrodinger's cat motif as a backdrop, you had another self twisting you in the moment. There's a little repeat notion in that idea as you briefly look back 20, 30, 40 seconds before because you were distracted and know you shouldn't have. So you get that little earth tweak, but it's already too late as everything unfolds rapidly in time. And I like the thought of all this this jumble of toucan canoes. And then thought of all of a sudden the Honda was crammed with 7 copies of myself, scrambled like spaghetti code, heads and pants, feet kicked and bit necks and mouths coming out of arms, windshield toucan again. And this notion of back and forth, pulling tug, going through the windshield, body being split into literally pieces without actually getting gory.
but working it out that way. Then the shaking his eggs that hatch toucan chicks in a spring jungle day. And then the thoughts, the last two lines, are a notion to afterlife and reincarnation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I like that you mentioned the line with about Schrodinger's cat and how there's this kind of, like, throughout the whole poem, this kind of like a breakdown of, you know, like just, you know, like this nervous breakdown energy to it. I also like that he went with the one-word title, Toucan. I thought that was really cool. And, yeah, I like that also, Rex, that you brought up those last two lines with the whole idea of the potential of that life will be lived again. So excellent comment there. And definitely some great humor throughout this. And Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I like the viewpoint of it, of describing, I mean, for me, how I interpreted it, it was a crazy teenager driving off and getting drunk and getting in a car accident. But I like the toucan's eye, that big, I mean, toucan, you think of the huge beak, but they also got that huge freaking beady eye on that bird that takes up the size of their brain. And so you've got like this overwhelming view of judgment, I guess is the best you would look at it, right? The toucan's eye, this big goofy bird eye that's staring at you going, what the hell are you doing, kid? You've really stepped in at this time. And as a side note, I won't get into it too deep, but Schrodinger's cat, I hate the philosophy of Schrodinger's cat. It's so misogynistic that the cat is either dead or alive. The cat knows if it's dead or it's alive. Our consciousness of that cat does not affect I won't get into it. Sorry, guys. Leon, I hate Schrodinger's. I hate Schrodinger's cat. I hate that. I hate. I try to argue it all the time. Anyway, very cool poem. Sorry, Leon. Very cool poem. I like what you did, and I like what Rex, what you said about. I think you nailed it when you said it's the perspective of it, of looking at what happened from outside and then going back and be retroactively evaluating what happened. So very cool poem.
And it was such a nice little absurd thought with humor laid into it. I got a kick out of it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, me too. And I like what you said about the judgment of the toucan eye. I thought that was a spot-on observation there, Jeremy. And I guess now, Rex, we know if we ever want to trigger Jeremy into getting angry, what we need to do a show about.
I could go off obnoxiously about stupid Schrodinger's cat. I don't know why that bugs me so much. Sorry.
No, I've used Schrodinger's cat a number of times. It's a well-worked theme if you surround it with the right language, and it just pops.
Oh, definitely. It does work well in poetry. But, yeah, it's definitely interesting. But, yeah, I really liked it. I liked the way he shaped the poem. I liked the energy of the poem. Another me pinched my ear from the passenger seat and twisted it like a beer cup that needed an opener. Ow, what? I like that idea of the back and forth of trying to convince yourself that you're going down the wrong path, but just not giving a damn anymore. Really just an excellent write and very well done. And all right, what do we got next?
I Am a Homebody by Poppy Day 8, and that one's yours.
All right. I Am a Homebody by Poppy Day 8. I dress myself in books of knowledge. Each page is hot as the words are erotic. Breakfast is the food of love, brought on the wings of a lovesick dove. I weep for those who are always happy. I am not destined to be a happy chappy. My home is inside me with room to extend. I might add an annex, but to what end? My heart is the kitchen where porridge boils over. My temper is cut short by my father's lawnmower. Home is rented from a time landlord who never fixes my leaking gut or broken heart. He is a busy bloke by all accord. End poem. Oh, that one was really clever and enjoyable. Very cool. I like that. And Rex, your thoughts?
It's lighthearted, whimsical humor, a little touch of self-deprecation rolled into it, and what else? The thought of the body being a home just rented by and owned by a time landlord. That's a clever thought. And the thought of he is a busy bloke by all accord. That kind of hits the note to God, so to speak. And the thought of dressing oneself in books of knowledge is a nice touch too. At least you're extending, even though you might not be happy, you're chappy, you're going to extend the bounds of who and what you are by actually delving into things that please the mind. And it offers up that note to being safe inside, even though you're not happy with that which is working on the outside.
I like that. And you're right. There is great humor. It does have that idea of self-deprivation. I did like how she separated home and body into two separate words in the title. I thought that was really cool. The first couple lines, address myself in books of knowledge, each page is hot as the words are erotic. It kind of changed things up. It became like, you know, at first you're thinking she's reading dictionaries, then you're thinking, well, maybe she's reading books with, what's his name, Fabio, on the cover.
Yeah.
With his blonde hair blowing back. And
Louis L'Amour?
Yeah. What's that?
Louis L'Amour books? Louis L'Amour?
Oh, no, he did. My grandfather used to love Louis L'Amour. He did westerns. That was a war.
There would be the romance novels of the 80s and 90s. There was that Fabio on the cover.
Yeah, talking about the really cheesy, like, romance novels.
Daniel Steele stuff.
Yes, that kind of stuff. That, you know, with the shirt ripped half open and the hair blowing in the wind and all that. Like, there was always wind around and it was always blowing in the right direction. So.
Yeah, it always lines like, she held the pulse of this throbbing house long to her chest.
Wasn't Fabio
a cowboy? In the honey of their making. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, and what was that, Jeremy?
Wasn't Fabio a cowboy? Wasn't he like a Clint Eastwood type?
No, he actually wasn't. He was.
He just wanted you to actually.
I don't know if you need to have, Jeremy, do you have, like, a headset or something you use? Because you're starting to sound like you're backing away from us. Like, you're in a tunnel, and you decided you're too close, so you have to back away.
No, I had you on speaker. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Okay, that makes sense. But, yeah, I really enjoyed this, and I liked it all the way through, but my favorite part was my heart is the kitchen where porridge boils over. My temper is cut short by my father's lawnmower. That was great. And, Jeremy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you guys hit a lot of it. I mean, this is really power to the introvert, right? Even in the title, it's a homebody with an exclamation point, and even the author noted the inside, it's saying that she hides inside of herself. I thought it was really cool. I think it was a cool perspective and a cool metaphor that she used with the house being herself and being her inner sanctuary. I like the lines that were pointed out earlier, home is rented from the time landlord who never fixes my leaky, broken heart. Yeah, I think it was and it was written – like you guys earlier said, in a very tongue-in-cheek way, that you're really cheering for this introvert, you know? I mean, introverts don't have a powerful voice, and I think because it is self-deprecating to a small degree, you kind of really are cheering for him. So it's not, aw, shucks, introvert. It's like, yeah, introvert, love yourself for who you are, and I'm kind of a little bit jealous with the way you have life. So very cool perspective, very cool poll.
Absolutely. I have to agree. I don't want to try to rush one last poem since we only have a few minutes left. So all the rest will have carryovers, which I'm either going to have on Rex's next After Midnight show or Into the Darkness so that we don't have to wait for the next Break On Through show. All right. Well, Rex, what are your topics and contests going to be or are for Rhythm and Rhyme and After Midnight this week?
Well, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. After Sunday.
All right.
And there's lots of openings.
Yes, yeah, and they've got some great songs. I'm looking forward to the Poetry That Inspires. I'll have to get the word out there, and hopefully some people will take a bite. How about After Midnight? Do we got a topic for that plan?
Wait a minute. How about Barker and Beyond the Veil?
I like it. Very cool. Very cool. And I've got some contests running for upcoming shows. So, just make sure to, when you get a chance, check those out. Also, make sure to check out all the contests and topic boards put up by our late night poets, hosts, and hostesses. Jeremy, thank you for calling in and joining us. It's always fun. Rex, thank you as always for being such a wonderful co-host. I truly appreciate you, and I always have a lot of fun with you. Thank you to everyone who wrote for the show, who is listening now or will be listening later. We truly appreciate you all. This has been a wonderful show, make sure to join us later tonight for Open Poetry with Fill My Eyes and Company, and 12:30 a.m. on Saturday morning, join us for Part Sinner, Part Saint with Faziana and Babbler. And then, of course, make sure to check out Rex's contest for his Sunday show, Rhythm and Rhyme, and be inspired by the music of Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. All right. And have a good night, everyone.
Good night, gang.